Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
It is kia ora. Kia ora, MOTAT, and kia ora, Marcus. How are you doing this morning?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Good. Glad to be back.
Nice to be face-to-face in the studio for a change.
Yeah, and got some exciting stories ahead. So I'm interested to know about this superconductor, which is at room temperature, which is apparently something quite exciting, because I guess to begin with, what are superconductors and what temperature are they normally, if not room temperature?
Superconductors are materials that are able to conduct electricity with zero resistance. In other words, there is no energy loss as the charge moves through the material. And these are very, very important materials for a whole wide range of applications, but not in the least, transmitting energy down long wires. You know, a lot of that energy is lost, and superconductors that would drop down to zero. Also applications in maglev trains and all sorts of other things, exciting things. But so this is a really, really exciting finding, because most materials actually become superconducting when you take them down to really, really, really low temperatures, so
right,
a few degrees above absolute zero. And there have been attempts for a long time now to try and find materials that are superconducting at room temperature, because if it's at room temperature, then you don't have to pay lots of money to keep them cool and refrigerate and things like that. So there are some very well-known materials that are superconducting above liquid nitrogen temperatures, and that's significant, but liquid nitrogen is fairly cheap to produce. There's a lot of nitrogen around in the air, and so there are some applications for superconducting materials that are superconducting at those temperatures, but that's still about minus 140 degrees or so.
Oh.
Which is cold.
yeah,
which is pretty cold. So it's been a lot of people have been working on trying to find materials that are superconducting at around room temperature, and they've found a material. It's not very well understood and it's not very well characterized yet, but it's found that they were able to see superconducting behavior at temperatures up to about 15 degrees C. So that's plus 15 degrees C. There's a slight wrinkle in that, yes, it is superconducting at 15, but it only is superconducting at extremely high pressures. So
right,
pressures more like the center of this planet, the center of the core of the Earth. So incredibly high pressures, at regular atmospheric pressure, it would certainly not be superconducting. But it's a step in the right direction, and it opens up a new avenue of research. And it's interesting because, you know, about 2 years ago, and I think we talked about it on the show, but about 2 years ago, they discovered a type of superconducting material that was superconducting at around about minus 10, minus 20, or something like that, degrees C. But that was only composed of two elements, lanthanum and hydrogen. Mm. This material comprises three elements rather than two, carbon, sulfur, and hydrogen. And the fact that it's got three elements greatly broadens the amount of sort of the combinations that can be included in future experiments. So there's more ways to sort of tweak the material now. So it's possible that they can start bringing that pressure down.
Because needless to say, keeping something at very low temperatures would be expensive. It seems like keeping things at very high pressure would probably be more expensive.
Yeah, well, if physically sort of impractical. I mean, we're talking 2.6 million times the atmospheric pressure at sea level. So,
right.
it's not feasible, but it's a step in the right direction.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, then to move on to the second topic, and it's interesting the way they've decided to phrase this article, NASA's fist-bumping asteroids. I mean, it's an interesting way to put it. What's the actual purpose of this mission? It's not just to go out there and give them a, hey, bro, what's up?
Well, it's not, obviously, but what they're actually doing is more of, instead of landing on an asteroid and digging around, so like they've got rovers roving around Mars and things, this is a body of rock that's been floating around space potentially since soon after the dawn of the solar system. And there's a lot of interest in what happened when the solar system started forming. And what what bodies were around, what was the chemistry, the geochemistry that occurred in those early days of the solar system. And so they think this rock could give a lot of clues to what was going on in those early days, because they think it's basically been floating around space for billions and billions of years. It's not very big, and this is sort of the key problem. You have rovers roving around Mars. It's like a planet. It's got decent amount of gravity. This rock is about the size of the Empire State Building in New York, so it's a relatively small body of rock. Mm-hmm. And so if you were standing on it, you know, you really wouldn't be very well connected. If you pushed up a little bit, you would float off into space. The gravitational field is very, very weak.
Right, hence the fist bumping. It's more.
Hence the fist. So what they've got, this is OSIRIS-REx probe launched in 2016. And it's following a couple of missions from the Japanese space agency that have gone to different asteroids and collected tiny amounts of dust from the asteroids and brought the process of bringing that back to Earth. But this mission, it actually lowers down, so it's currently sort of in the vicinity of the asteroid, and it's going to lower down very, very slowly to the surface. But just a small distance away from the surface, and it's going to expel sort of a puff of nitrogen, which will kick up a cloud of dust and debris, which hopefully it will collect. They're looking to get about 50 grams or so of material. If it doesn't do it the first time, it'll lower itself back down, try it again, and try and get enough material, and then go away. So it doesn't actually touch down or sort of rove around or anything like that.
Yeah.
And the slight wrinkle was, this is, they did try to do Earth observations of this thing, but it's a long way away, and they couldn't really see the surface very clearly or at all, really. So they thought, they'd hoped it would be fairly smooth. It certainly isn't. There's lots of big boulders and things, sort of, it's very, very rough surface. And so they didn't really, when they got there, they were a bit worried, because they didn't. It was going to be difficult to lower down to the surface when there was lots of boulders and rocks around. But they found this fairly small, just a few square meter sort of patch of a crater that is relatively smooth. And it was like sort of going down, between skyscrapers almost, down into this little crater, and then lowering it and then raising itself back up again. So they've had to work a lot on doing this automatically, because the probe is a long, long, long way from Earth. They can't, the time it takes for the signals to get from the probe to Earth mean that they can't control it directly, so it's all has to be autonomously controlled. And so this is going to be happening in the next few weeks, I think, and the going into this sort of 16-meter wide crater, and hopefully bring back some materials in about 2 years, 2 or 3 years from now, once it finally makes its way back to Earth. And so this will be actually the biggest sample return. And it's only about 50, 60 grams, but it's the biggest sample return since Apollo.
Wow.
But potentially, if it works.
Yeah.
And then they'll be able to take that material, study its chemistry, understand a lot more about how the solar system was formed.
Very exciting. Oh, we'll have another episode of Dear Science in 2 years' time when they get those results back.
Yes.
And now, so to move to this last story, a bit of a fun one that we were going to touch on the other week, but we were busy talking about Nobel Prizes, salt and how it makes fruit and lollies sweet. Now, I'm sure this is something that many people are already aware of, but this is kind of the first time they've been able to prove why that's the case.
Yeah. So first of all, I think this story is worthy of a Nobel Prize, but most people know that if you have salted caramel, it tastes a little bit sweeter. It tastes a bit better than just sugary material by itself. So sweet food gets sweeter when you add a little bit of salt. And it wasn't really understood quite why this was the reason for this, because scientists knew that there was this family of receptors in your taste buds called T1R, which pick up natural sugars and artificial sweeteners, and you pick up that sweet sense. And originally, about 15 years ago, scientists thought that disabling that receptor would stop any response to the sweetness, so you wouldn't be able to detect sweet things anymore. But it turns out that that mice can, and they've shown that they can, and they found a different mechanism for detecting the sweetness, and this is something called a co-transporter, sodium glucose co-transporter, so SGLT1, I think it's labeled, and this co-transporter, this mechanism uses sodium, as in sodium from salt, to carry glucose into cells and then sort of give the cells energy. And this protein is found in these sweet responsive taste cells. So it was found that in the experiments with mice that even with the original receptor turned off, the mice were able to, that they could detect a physical response in the mice that responded to a sweet response when they used sodium salt with sweet foods, and they connected it with this protein that carries both materials into cells.
And so they concluded there's actually three types of sweet sensitive taste cells.
Yes, and it's, so the two types I've talked about, and the final type employs both pathways, and it also responds to fatty acids and umami flavors. And the researchers propose that these provide a way to detect very calorie-rich foods. So this sort of taste spectrum is getting broader and more complex as with research.
And interestingly, it didn't do the same for artificial sweeteners. Was that the case?
No, and I think this second pathway is glucose specific, so it's more specific for natural sugars rather than artificial sugars.
That's very interesting then. All right. Well, thank you very much, Marcus. We'd better let you go and get to class. But it's been great to have you here back in the studio, and we'll see you again in a fortnight's time.
Great. See you then.
And for everyone who's listening in, stay tuned after this. We'll be back with more.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
The best